Hey everyone, it's your host Greg Houle here. I want to take a moment to thank you all for listening to the Salem Witch Trials podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure developing and presenting these episodes over the last several months. I've been overwhelmed by your positive response, and I can't thank you enough. We have many more episodes coming in the weeks and months ahead, so I hope you'll continue to listen and share and tell your friends. I also want to let you know about my new book, which will be out this September 2024. It's a historical fiction novel called The Putnams of Salem, a novel of power and betrayal during the Salem witch trials. The book tells the story of the witch crisis through the eyes of my own relatives, Thomas Putnam Jr. and his oldest daughter, Anne. And if you like the podcast, I think you'll really like this book, which is full of action and even has a few twists and turns along the way. The book will be available in print, digital, and audio formats, and you can find out more at theputnamsofsalem.com. That's theputnamsofsalem.com. You can pre-order the book now, so I hope you'll check it out. Thanks again for listening. I'm really grateful for your support. To many of us, Oyer and Terminer seems like an odd-sounding name for a court based in America. It's a term that means to hear and to determine in an old style of French, making it all the more awkward of a name for an English special court. Yet courts of Oyer and Terminer have a long history in both the United Kingdom and the United States, having often been convened for limited periods of time to hear serious cases, such as murder or treason. And in May 1692, the newly installed governor of the newly named province of Massachusetts Bay, William Phipps, was facing a serious crisis of his own at a time when his colony's legal authority had been stifled. More than six decades earlier, in 1628, a charter was granted by King Charles I to establish the Massachusetts Bay Colony in New England. In essence, the charter outlined the colony's territory and how it was meant to be governed. As a charter colony, Massachusetts was granted a measure of autonomy. It was able to establish its own administration among the colonists who lived there, in return for sharing some of the wealth they extracted from their new land with the mother country. It was a fairly unique situation at the time, and one that provided those who had immigrated to Massachusetts, many of whom were Puritans who came during the Great Puritan Migration of the 1630s and 40s, with the autonomy that they had been seeking for so long and had not been able to find in Europe. But after decades of mostly blazing their own trail, the Puritans who ran Massachusetts would find out the hard way that mighty England still held ultimate sway over their colony. In 1684, 56 years after the establishment of that unique charter, England revoked it for what it claimed were a series of violations. The authorities in Massachusetts were accused of illegally trading with other countries, as well as illegally minting their own money, among other things. But the real problem seemed to lie in the fact that the Puritans had essentially been ignoring English law in favor of their own Puritan interpretations of it, and the mother country wanted to reassert some measure of control over its wayward territory. Of course, the Puritans were well established in Massachusetts by this time, and they tended to look down upon outsiders who were in their midst. They liked their power and their land, their so-called city upon a hill, and they didn't wish to share it with anyone, despite the fact that they had come to Massachusetts specifically to escape their own religious persecution in Europe Most Puritans didn't seem to notice the irony of their own discrimination against people of other religions in America. When King Charles II died shortly after Massachusetts' charter was revoked, his successor, King James II, a Catholic, was no friend of the Puritans. He took the further step of consolidating the New England colonies together into what was known as the Dominion of New England. In essence, the English crown was looking to reassert its power over their entire New England territory and blunt some of the Puritan domination that had existed there for decades. But the Puritans in Massachusetts had a stroke of good luck. An event known today as the Glorious Revolution swept through England a few years later, deposing James II and replacing him with William and Mary. The new dual monarchs ended the Dominion of New England. And with advocacy from Increase Mather and other agents representing Massachusetts in London, a new royal charter for the colony was established in 1691, just months before the witch hysteria first struck Salem. It was 41-year-old William Phipps who brought the new charter to Massachusetts when he sailed there to take up his new post as governor of the colony, arriving in mid-May 1692. Governor Phipps was eager to heal old wounds and get along with his new Puritan allies, vowing to rule with a soft touch. But by the time he stepped off the ship and onto Massachusetts soil, he found himself in the middle of a growing crisis. It seemed to be raging out of control. Because the new charter had only just taken effect, there were no courts to handle the mounting number of accused witches who were sitting in putrid jails in Salem, Boston, and elsewhere. Strangely enough, Massachusetts' new governor had been born in the New World himself, in the wilds of the Maine frontier of all places, during the middle part of the 17th century. His father owned and operated a trading post that helped to facilitate commerce of fur and weapons between European settlers and the native Wabanaki people. William was the youngest of the children, and he was said to have had more than a dozen brothers and sisters. He came of age in the rugged wilderness of the eastern frontier without any formal education at all, and he was likely barely even literate as an adult. While he was a boy, he spent several years working as a carpenter's apprentice near his home, before eventually moving to Boston to work as a ship's carpenter. It was William's marriage to the prosperous widow Mary Spencer Hull in 1673, when he was in his early 20s, that raised him out of obscurity. Eventually, William became a ship captain, and interestingly enough, a treasure hunter, who once famously found hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of sunken treasure in the Caribbean. It was a feat seemingly drawn from the pages of an old-time adventure story. But it earned William much recognition, a knighthood, and perhaps most importantly, the favor of the English crown. For a man who had gotten his start in the backwoods frontier of the empire, it was a meteoric rise. While the new charter was now in effect in 1692, there had not been enough time to establish any courts, and with a growing backlog of accused witches sitting in horrid jails, as well as the continued growing hysteria, Phipps knew that he had to act quickly, so he decided to establish a special court, the Court of Oyer and Terminer, to handle the proceedings. Governor Phipps put his Lieutenant Governor William Stoughton in charge, and he filled out the court with six additional men from the kind of background one might expect. wealthy merchants. Much like the magistrates who had been overseeing the questioning of suspected witches, John Hawthorne and Jonathan Corwin, Stoughton in the Court of Oyer and Terminer approached the accused with the presumption of guilt, and that approach would prove to be devastating over the course of the court's 5 months of work. Chief Justice William Stoughton was born in England in the early 1630s, just before immigrating with his parents to Dorchester, Massachusetts. He attended Harvard University and went back to England to study further at Oxford. Like all Harvard graduates at the time, Stoughton was a member of the clergy, but his heart seemed to be in politics and administering justice. He served as a selectman in Dorchester during the 1670s and was able to adeptly weave his way through the political turmoil between Massachusetts and England during the 1680s, even serving a leadership role during the ill-fated Dominion of New England period. While Stoughton himself was not a member of a well-known family, his skillful political aptitude and experience as a judge seemed to position him for a leadership role on the new court, and Governor Phipps took the opportunity to put him in that position. Governor Phipps might have felt a particular discomfort when it came to the growing paranoia that was surrounding the witch crisis in Salem. As historian Emerson Baker notes, while Phipps might have been the most famous English colonist living in America at the time, there were a number of aspects about the new governor's life that might have predisposed him to some suspicion. Governor Phipps had only just converted to Puritanism in 1690, and he most obviously did so for political reasons. He was also said to have a nephew living in nearby Beverly, who was thought to be, quote, under the evil hand himself, presumably afflicted by a witch. In addition, as a former successful treasure hunter, the governor was thought to possess some kind of unique power. After all, how could one find sunken treasure buried in the deepest ocean without some sort of power on their side? He even once admitted to having his fortune read. Moreover, the governor's wife, Lady Mary, had a relative who was once accused of witchcraft. And of course, like so many others who were involved in the witch crisis in Salem, Governor Phipps spent time on the main frontier, a place crawling with heathen Wabanakis and often seen as forsaken by God. Governor Phipps certainly must have known enough about the paranoid Puritans living among him in his new home to recognize that he couldn't afford to be seen as taking the witch hysteria lightly. Setting up the special court of Oyer and Terminer and putting the firebrand William Stoughton in charge of it might have been what the new governor felt he needed to do, and do quickly, in order to prevent any undue suspicion on him and his family. It's also easy to imagine Governor Phipps not wanting word of the growing crisis to get back to the authorities in London. In fact, the governor seemed to take pains to avoid bringing up the subject when communicating with the government back in England. What if the court had never been formed? What if Governor Phipps had taken a different, more measured approach? Or what if the governor had put someone else in charge of the court? Of course, we'll never know the answers to these questions, and the Court of Oyer and Terminer, as well as Chief Justice William Stoughton, would go on to become infamous. The actions of the court, and more specifically, the actions of Stoughton, would prove to be calamitous. We'll continue to explore this fascinating and tragic story in our episodes to come. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.